Listeners, did you know each year Americans throw away 25% more trash from Thanksgiving to New Year's? This year, let's turn our New Year's resolution into actions that make a difference by switching to Blue Land. An estimated 5 billion plastic hand soap and cleaning bottles are thrown away each year. And if that's not bad enough, most cleaning formulas are 90% water, which is heavy to ship, leading to excessive carbon emissions. Plus, those products are often filled with nasty ingredients like chlorine and ammonia. It's a lose-lose situation for us and the planet. But Blue Land has made it their mission to do something about it. The idea is simple. They offer refillable cleaning products with a beautiful, cohesive design that looks great on your counter. You just fill your reusable bottles with water, drop in the tablets, and wait for them to dissolve. Refills start at just $2.25. Tab and I are loving Blue Land. We love how great the products work and smell, and the space saving from just having refillable tablets to store instead of bulky bottles is great. Also, we love having it shipped to our doors. It's so convenient and just one less thing to think about at the grocery store. And hello, Blue Land saves you money and helps the planet. What is not to love about that? Blue Land has a special offer for our listeners. Right now, get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/clink. You won't want to miss this. blueland.com/clink for 15% off. That's blueland.com/clink to get 15% off. Lady listeners, could your daily routine be full of hormone disruptors? It sure can. You know, there are more than 1,000 hormone disruptors living rent-free in our environment right now, in our food, our water, the air we breathe, the clothes we wear, and they all mess with our hormones. Then there's the natural hormonal changes our bodies go through. Perimenopause, menopause, and while it's a natural process, it doesn't mean we have to suffer through it. The good news is that we don't have to suffer through it anymore because now we have Hormone Harmony, a formula made with herbal ingredients that are shown to reduce hormonal symptoms in women of all ages. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier, and that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. Hormone Harmony is a phenomenon. Women can't stop talking about it on social media. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds, y'all. Hormone Harmony has been part of my routine in 2024 and will continue to be in 2025 because, simply put, it makes me feel better. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use code CLINK at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use code CLINK for 15% off today. You don't need to feel like financial wellness is impossible. Acorns gives you small, simple steps to get you and your money on track. What I love about Acorns is knowing I am doing something proactive for my future. And it's not a time suck because basically Acorns does the hard part for you so you can give your money a chance to grow. So head to acorns.com/clink or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid client testimonial. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, and SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/clink.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close.
Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Hi, and welcome to Housewives of True Crime.
Welcome.
Welcome. I am Tabitha. Give me Dateline, white wine, and I'll pick up your kids in the carpool line.
The next day, right?
Yeah, the next day.
Okay. And I am Gretchen. I like white wine, true crime, and in bed by 9 because I have a lot of stuff to do in the morning.
We are Housewives of True Crime.
Yes, we are.
Yes, we are.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Housewives of True Crime.
Hi.
very special edition. The most special. So I would suggest you keep listening.
Yeah, Disco Biscuit Explosion coming your way.
Like and subscribe and follow and do all the things, because this one is worth a listen, because we talk to the one and only Barbara Bentley, who we just covered not too long ago, and she is such a pleasure to talk to.
Yeah, really goes to show how this stuff, I mean, it's been, you know, decades since the story of her crime and, you know, y'all listen to the episode, like happened to her and how much it has stayed with her and become such a part of her and changed her and, you know, but it's still, it's a story of hope and, you know, go with your gut instincts, people, and speak up. And we all have to learn about these con men.
Yeah.
Con women. Conners. Connie con cons. Stop
it. This is true. Yeah. I mean, also just, also the domestic violence portion of it, where you just sometimes you're in it and you don't even realize you're in it. So
yeah,
that too. But anyways, I hope you all enjoy Barbara Bentley. Welcome. We have a very special guest today that we have told you a little bit about, Barbara Bentley. And welcome, Barbara.
Thank you, Tabitha and Gretchen. It's really great to be with you, and I really feel honored.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Gretchen and I rarely ever reach out to somebody that is a victim. And after I read Barbara's book in 2022, I just was drawn to call and talk to her. And so I emailed, and a couple of years later, we're finally here. And it's actually kind of interesting, Barbara, because Gretchen does a lot of con cases. And so this really is kind of more up her alley than mine. But this movie that is talk of the nation right now, It Ends With Us. Have you heard of this movie?
No.
Gretchen went and saw some of it. But it is about domestic violence in a way that is kind of hidden. And I feel like your story is that also.
You know, domestic violence can be very clandestine. Of course, physical violence, you hear of people being battered. But there's also sexual violence, there's verbal violence, and emotional violence. And those are very rarely talked about. When people talk about domestic violence, they're thinking about somebody being battered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's so poignant that it's like, it, because it is something that we don't talk about enough, is that maybe people don't realize that, you know, the thing about that kind of violence is maybe they just broke something, or maybe they just verbally cut you down or whatever. But it's when it's done in such a cutting way, it really only has to be done once to just leave you shook. Mm-hmm. And to always have that like fear looming over it, and just to make you more complacent into the whole, you know, cycle of how it plays out.
Well, after what I call the event, after John tried to murder me, I was sitting in about a month later, sitting in a hotel room in Indianapolis. I was on a business trip, and I thought, why did this happen to me? And what am I supposed to do with this? And I came up with the idea that I needed to write a book. I needed to share my story of being an intelligent woman who was caught up in this web of deceit without realizing it, and of how it happened. And some people have said, oh, well, you should have known, you know, oh, you were stupid, you know? And I said, oh no. I said, how could I say I'm stupid? I equal the Navy, you know? And, but anyway, it was, yeah. So I started on a quest of deciding to write this book, and I've done well in school, but writing a book was something new. So I went to workshops. I joined the International Women's Writing Guild. I tried to hone the craft. And when I started to write the book, I didn't even realize at that time that I would end up changing the divorce law of California.
So amazing.
So, yeah. So, and what was really amazing was that, you know, when I finished the book, it took quite a few years just for a lot of different reasons. I had remarried by that time. And my husband had quadruple bypass surgery. And so I came home from that ordeal. I was very exhausted. And I thought, well, I'll just check my email. And there was the email from the agent in New York saying she wanted to represent my book. I said, you know, God is strange in the way that things get handled. So there I was at the ultimate low and an ultimate high to get me back onto an even keel. And so, yeah, the book is written with a preference preface to talk about domestic violence and these other different ways that it manifests itself. And so that anybody reading the book who maybe they don't understand it will at least now have keys to see what's happening in the story. I very rarely read the negative. Well, I only read the negative reviews on my Amazon reviews.
Oh, don't do that.
So it was interesting. I think it was good because it was like, there are such haters out there.
Oh, and, we know.
And this person says, she deserved everything she got. She was stupid, yada, yada. And I looked at that and I thought, you just recognize yourself as being an antisocial. You're either a sociopath, a psychopath, right, or a narcissist.
Yes. Yeah.
No, I don't let those bring me down because I know what I've done with the book and with the law and, you know, to judge somebody when you've never even met them face to face.
Yeah. And it's so important that your story and similar women who have been con stories are continue to be told, because people do need to hear that there are signs to look out for, and they need to hear it more than once. They need to hear it a lot, but it's really the only way we're ever going to be able to help our friends or family members we see in that kind of situation, even if we can't, you know, recognize it for ourselves or they can't recognize it for themselves, is being educated about how these things work and they can happen.
Yes.
I was conned. You were conned.
Yes. And I maintain a website for my book. It's adancewiththedevil.com. And on that, I have a whole section on psychopaths. And under that is a list of red flags to look for. Under recovery, I have a whole list of things that people can use, places to go for recovery if they need that. And I have a section on advocacy if they wanted to change a law. And I also have a section on writing if somebody wants to write their story. So I feel like you're saying, you know, you want to educate, and that's what my website is about. It's just trying to educate, helping people, give you tools that maybe you don't see it in yourself, but you see it in a family member or a friend, and that you can put it out there.
Do you think, did anybody in your realm of friends ever not believe that John was who he was, or did you have any outlet, like a girlfriend? Like, if for instance, right now I'm going through something that we think maybe somebody's conning us, and you need some sort of outlet to kind of say, hey, you know, is this normal? Does this, you know, or did you keep everything inside? Did anybody have any guidance to you?
What was interesting was that after the event, then people would tell me, oh, well, we didn't think he was who he said he was. And oh, da, da, da. And I was like, well, wait a minute. Why didn't you say anything to me beforehand? Nobody no said, you know, this man doesn't seem like he is who he is, you know, and of course this all happened before the internet. So
Right. Nowadays
it's so easy. It's much easier to check up on somebody, but no, I didn't have that. You know, we did things with family, with friends, you know, they were validating. So if you don't speak up, but you see something, then you're to that person that's a victim or in that circumstance, you're validating that that situation that they're in is okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's so complicated though, right? Because, you know, we've all had someone in our life who we did not particularly care for their significant other. And, you know, it gets really confusing when you're saying, it's not that I don't care for them, I'm just concerned. But it's easy for people to get that twisted when you're talking to them and you risk damaging that relationship. I think a lot of times people just don't want to do that.
Well, then look at the alternative. Would you rather be going to their funeral?
Absolutely. It's so we have to do is realize how detrimental it is that you do take that risk.
Right. And you know, you can approach somebody in ways that, you know, wouldn't put them on the defensive, you know, that,
right.
Like, why would you, if you didn't like somebody, why would you be in a social situation and, you know, go out on double dates or whatever? Why would, as long as you're in that situation, if you're accepting that person that you don't like, that by being in the situation, tricky, but no, I've practiced this sense myself that I said, you know, I value that friendship, but I'm going to say something. And then if the friendship falls apart, then it wasn't as solid as I thought. But at least I said something, and that, you know, I wouldn't have to worry about it if it turned out bad, that I didn't try to warn that person.
Right. I could see that. So I think most of our listeners probably have listened to the story about you, but Barbara had met a very charming man named John Perry one night, and you didn't even want to go meet him, but you ended up going on this double date, right? Or was it a triple date?
Well, my friend was having a dinner party, and she had invited this, it wasn't a party, but a dinner, and she had invited the gentleman that was working with her husband. And she always liked, she said, he always liked to set an even table, so she wanted a fourth for that night.
Okay.
And so that was, it wasn't like I was going out with him. I just was, I was meeting him in this situation.
Right. And he was quite a talker. And from...
Oh. Yes. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Do you want me to say more about him?
Oh, I can expound on, okay. You know, he was very charming, very attentive, and had a lot of stories that, you know, it just was very interesting. Like he talked about that he had won the Congressional Medal of Honor for service in Vietnam, and he was in charge of the black boats, and he had stories of how he was injured, and he had stories of being in the Blue Angels twice. And what's interesting is that later on in our situation, we did meet the Blue Angels, and they, you know, they signed a paper, a picture for him, the Rear Admiral Perry. And then also he was very talkative about his family, and that his father was Admiral Perry that started the Seabees in World War II, which I learned was true. Mm-hmm. And he said that the Seabees movie with John Wayne, that was about his father. And so because of that, John Perry said that he was at the filming and he met John Wayne and he was his friend, and that was false, but we didn't know that at the time. He said he was the black sheep of the family. And because he was, they just persona non grata with everybody. And later on, I would find out that was true. He said he was estranged from four children. And that was false because I later found out after the murder attempt that there were no kids.
Which is so strange to me. Why would you want to make up having children that don't talk to you? I mean, it doesn't particularly portray you in a good light.
It's for sympathy.
Oh, it's for sympathy. You're supposed to feel sorry for that.
Right, right. You want to attract a woman. Oh. You
see, I think
off.
You must be a real jerk if your kids don't, if all four of your kids won't talk
but
to you.
But he had validating stories that went along with it. And a lot of times for everything that John would say in his stories, there was always a kernel of truth. So it wasn't that he had children, but somewhere there was something of a kernel of truth. But he was, and he said he owned property in Florida and California. And in today's world, if you meet somebody and they start telling you all of these things that they own property, you immediately go to the internet and find out, do they really own property?
Right.
But, and then he said that his father was stationed at Pearl Harbor. And so he was hiding under his bed when Pearl Harbor was attacked. So it's all these fascinating stories. And, you know, he was fascinating and just very interesting in that way.
You know, one of the things that just really blew my mind was the part about that you went to George Bush's inaugural ball.
Right.
How did that shake out? How could you possibly get in?
I don't know. He came home one day with an invitation to the inaugural ball.
I mean, he conned everybody, this man. And really, I mean, wined and dined you. And you guys flew all over the world. And so why wouldn't you get an invitation to the White House, you know?
Well, yeah, for the inauguration. And so we went to the inauguration and we actually had seats, assigned seats on the lawn. And then we went to the parade. And when we got there, we sat in the Medal of Honor stand because he was wearing his Congressional Medal of Honor. And that's where even the president stops and turns around and salutes everybody in the Medal of Honor stands. And then we were at the ball, which was totally different. It wasn't like, you know, a Cinderella ball. Anyway, it was very interesting. And so then we were standing and the newly elected president and his wife and Bob Hope, I think, and his wife and were up and up on this balcony, and it was hard to see. And so we were invited to go stand up with the squadron that the president had served with. So because John was wearing the Congressional Medal of Honor, and, you know, it just is It's a very interesting situation to be in. I've been piped aboard ships as an admiral and his wife with other admirals and their wives.
Yeah, I mean, and it's so easy to see how it can, you, how do you even question who he is when things like this are happening? Because that seems impossible that he could have made that happen without it, there being some validity to it. Right. But did you ever find out how did he get those medals, or is that still a mystery?
Well, it's a mystery, but I think he probably bought them somewhere, you know, that I don't know, that I've never tried to do it myself, but there's the military stores. And with it by uniform, whatever. And so, you know, maybe the admiral can walk in there and say, oh, I'm sorry, I lost my bars. Could you sell me some more bars, or, you know, who knows?
Sure.
Yeah. I wonder, I also was wondering, because his dad was an admiral, do you think that they could have been his father's? Like he stole them?
I don't think so.
No.
I don't think so. No. I never thought of that, but he and his father had become estranged. You know, as I wrote the book and I read books about sociopaths, psychopaths, one of the theories is that people can hit their head, and where they weren't that personality before, they turn into that personality. And then once you're into that personality, you can never undo the damage. And when he was 16, he had gone into the service, lying about his age, trying, I guess, to please his father, who knows. But on his first leave, he and some buddies, they were diving into a swimming pool, and he hit his head. And he was in the hospital for a couple months. And that he had this as part of his story, that turned out true, because I did finally meet his stepmother after the trial. But she said, when I did meet the stepmother, she said after that, John was never the same. And he was getting into all kinds of trouble and just causing a lot of grief for his father. And so there was that estrangement there. The father, I guess, tried to give him mental help, and it just didn't work. And John ended up, I found he was a con man with an FBI record. And the stepmother said that she felt that John's behavior is what caused his dad to have an early heart attack in his 50s. So there was an estrangement there, so that he would have anything of his father's would be very unlikely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that occurred to us was we were wondering if maybe, were you familiar with the whole Dirty John phenomenon and the podcast and the series that was made about him a couple of years ago?
No.
You weren't? Okay. So it has been kind of a phenomenon, and I think it has really kind of opened people's eyes to what this kind of con looks like. Basically, this John love bombed this woman, and he had this big life too. You know, he was a doctor. He would bring her smoothies in bed. Just sounds great.
It sounded, you know, dreamy. I mean, every woman listening to this is like, yeah, sign me up.
And there was a really captivating story about it, made into a podcast and then a series that I think really opened people's eyes to how this kind of stuff happens over.
But it was
over
the same
time.
It was the same situation, Barbara, where
so many similarities.
She had money because she was a interior designer that was really successful in Orange County. And basically he saw her somewhere and thought that
that was his next mark.
Yes. Yeah. And so it's the same situation happened with you. And this is before this situation. But John saw you as a way to means, and I mean means of monetary means for himself, but it took a long time to get there. And we had talked on the phone because this was a 10-year marriage that you had to him. So it was not short, but he played the long game with you. And one thing you told me before was because you thought you created a lot of happiness for him, but in there was the crazy year you talk about. And the crazy year is for about a year, I think is what you said, and you can clarify, he attempted to murder you a few times.
Right. Well, you know, as the marriage progressed for the 9 years, he would always tell me that I made him the happiest he had ever been in his life. And after talking with his stepmother, I truly believe that that was what was going on, that if he wanted to get money from me, he would have, like on so many sad stories we hear, that he would have gotten up insurance and I would have died within the first year. Mm-hmm. But there was something in his soul that he was having a good time being part of a family, with my family and my nephew and our good friends and that my life was dangerous at the point where he realized his con of me wasn't worth, I was going to find out what his con was because he started to being investigated by NCIS and the FBI. And so it got to this last year was critical for him. And so he was looking for then truly the financial payoff. And it's not like I had a lot of money but I was, I was okay. And yeah, so this crazy last year of our life was, it started off, there was first of all, let me preface this with after the murder attempt, we were, it was in a hotel and, the whole situation, and if you want to talk again about, did I talk with him later, anytime after that?
Oh, but yes.
So after the murder attempt, we were taken through a process to a mental facility. And while at that mental facility, I was in a separate room and I was looking down at the floor. And then one of the directors, she said, oh, there's a homicide detective here to meet you. And by this time I had gone back into the codependency issue. And I said, well, John really didn't try to murder me. He's just sick and he needs to go to a hospital and get care. And this is true. And it's in the book. I looked at these brown shoes and I'm looking up. I said, well, homicide detective. And I looked up into his face and it goes, wow, he's good looking. and God sent me an angel. He sent me an angel who saved my life that day because the detective started questioning me. Well, have you had any interesting situations in the last year that, and I said, let's see. Well, there was the car accident in Arkansas at Easter and where through a series of events, John kind of drugged me so he could drive and he drove off the road. And the next day we saw that I missed my side by just inches of being crammed into a tree. And then at the tail end of that, I'm on a business trip. So at the tail end of that, I go off to Indianapolis and a couple days later, he shows up in the hotel and he's surprised that I have a hotel room that's real close to the lobby. Apparently he had called because when I checked in, the guy said, oh, I got you your room. It was way in the back and the yada, yada. And then at that time, he had brought a bottle of ether and plastic gloves with him. And there was an excuse, a story of, oh, the doctor told me to put the, on my alley. So there was probably going to be the second murder attempt. And then there was a trip to Florida. There were actually two trips. We were going to meet with his family. And in the last one, we were going to go and get a loan on his property that he owned. But remember, I said he didn't really own any property.
Right. In Florida.
And he had a heart attack, supposedly. And he was in ICU ICU intensive care for 3 days and in a regular heart ward for 3 days. And I would find out later that he took a combination of drugs to create that. But when I went back to the room to pack up our stuff to move to a hotel closer to the hospital, I found a whole bunch of drugs in his briefcase and then a gun wrapped in tinfoil that he'd actually taken through security for the airplane. So I would find out later that those drugs he had used again when he died, he used those to make it look like he had a heart attack. The next time, so he was probably going to try to shoot me on that one. Then the next time was fall down the stairs. He said he was teaching at the University of California, Davis, because he had a doctor of psychology, which he really didn't. But I was getting more upset with him. And I said, well, I want to go to one of your classes. So we're ready to go. And would both of us fall down the stairs. So that was probably another murder attempt. And then when I started wondering about all of this, it just... in real life, it was like in real time, not looking back with the detective, was that I went to, I figured I needed to investigate him. And of course, we didn't have the internet at the time. So I went to the library. He said that he was that he had gotten the Medal of Honor in the Vietnam War. There was a book on Medal of Honor winners in Vietnam War, and John was not listed. And I jocked some pages from that. And he said that, he was the son of Admiral Perry. I found Admiral Perry's obituary in the New York Times. John wasn't listed. I would find out later that he wasn't listed because he was the black sheep of the family, but I didn't see him listed there. And And I kept asking John, who are you? And I would get the same stories over and over. And then finally I showed him this evidence that I had found that, you know, you should be in this book, and you should be in your dad's obituary. And he had some stories. Well, you know, that they probably just accidentally left him out. And it just was bullshit, really. And so he realized that I was getting close. And
yeah.
So then he came up with a story about going, that the government wanted him to have a contract. He had a contract to go to Egypt and participate in the peace talks in the Middle East. There was a war going on at the time. And because I like to go, I always wanted to go to Egypt. The admiral in charge said that I could go for 2 weeks. And so this was to help. All of this during this year, all this craziness is because we had gotten financially in debt because he wasn't working like he said he was. And his family wouldn't come through with the money. I mean, that was always the carrot that he held out for me. Well, I'll eventually get my inheritance, and, you know, it'll take care of all the bills. So he just came up with this ruse, which is what it was. And we ended up in Washington, D.C., ran around for 2 days looking for this admiral. We could never connect with the admiral that was going to give us the tickets and whatever. And so then that was where he planned the final attack. Because he took out insurance that we'd done on rental cars. He got the room in the back of the hotel. He had the ether, and that's where I had the battle for my life. He tried to smother me to death with ether.
And you were a really smart lady because you knew to, you know, hold your breath. And then something that I found just really intriguing is you sat with him for a second, correct?
Well, more than a second. Because now I'm, you know, when you're in this kind of a situation, Now it's like a bunch of fog, you know, what's true, what isn't true? Is he really mm-hmm. sick? Does he need to go to the hospital? I mean, you know, yeah, maybe he just found out he had cancer. That was his, I didn't know that at the point. Well, so at the end of the attack, he was actually had me pinned to the floor and had my hands pinned. And he had finished pouring ether on my face. And I just kept moving my head. Yeah. I worked in a lab, so I knew the smell of ether. So it was like, oh, this is bad stuff.
Yeah. You're not going to breathe it in.
Yeah, so he ran out of the ether, and now he's sitting on top of me, and I have both my arms pinned with his hands. And I looked up at him, and he's looking at me with his wild eyes, and I said, John, if there's a problem, we can talk about this. Mm-hmm. And it was like, okay, this time failed. Well, I'll have to think of another way. Or whatever was going on in his mind, he actually got up, and he was very tired. He was older than I was, like I said, and I was tired. So he went and laid down on the bed, and I sat next to him, and I took his arm, and I said, well, John, why did you do this? And that's when he said, well, I just found out I'm dying of cancer, and I wanted to just put you under so I could go and jump off the Key Bridge and commit suicide. And that was like, oh, okay. Well, then he went to sleep, and I literally sat on that bed, and I thought to myself, I had a discussion with myself of what should I do? You know, does he really have cancer? Does he really need to go get help? And then I decided, no, I needed to leave that room or I wouldn't leave it alive. And so I quietly got up, stood at the end of the bed. He didn't move, went to the door, didn't hear anything, opened it quietly and ran through the hotel on my bare feet to the desk and said, call the police. My husband just tried to murder me with ether.
Yeah, I'm so glad you did that, Barbara.
Yeah, it's such a powerful story. One thing that I think that a common theme that I see with women who are telling these stories, and it was my case personally, and I'm wondering if it is true for you, is that it's when you actually retell the story that it starts to make sense to you.
Well, that's that happened during the book.
Yeah.
And people said, oh, was it cathartic to write the book? And I said, no, by the time I decided to write the book, I had done my couple of sessions of therapy. I was fine writing the book. It wasn't like I needed to write it for me. I was writing it for others.
But sometimes you just have to say these things out loud to, you know, put it into perspective of how it all happened. Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah. There's, you know, you're talking with friends, and then I've had the good fortune of being on your podcast to also have been on Dateline with my story. Mm-hmm. With Final Justice, Aaron Brockovich's show, and several other, there was a Canadian show I did, a true crime show. know, and talking in speeches. I go and talk to organizations. And yeah, so it's like when we were going to do the podcast. It had been a long enough time since I had thought about this stuff. So I just wanted to kind of write some things out. I had asked Tabitha to send me a list of questions that she might, you know, of subjects that she'd be interested in. And I sat there and I could type away and, you know, remember it all. I didn't have to go and look anything up. But yeah. So, you know, one question that comes up is, why does she stay? Or, you know, in my case, well, why did you stay? And while all this crazy making was going on, the crazy making comes from these con men. They'll create a story, and then if you start to not believe it, then they're very good at doing a 180, and the story becomes different. And by the time of the end of it, you think you're crazy for doubting what they had to say. And that's why the movie Gaslight, it's about that. And that's why they call it gaslighting. Right. And in my book, I call it crazy making, because in this web of deceit, you begin to think that you're crazy in yourself, that you're doubting things.
Well, you just said you doubted yourself for even a second when that whole thing just happened. Sat on the bed.
Right. And what I did find out was that I was also in the throes of codependency. So after this happened, I knew I needed to go seek some help, because none of us are trained in life to take this kind of a situation and then just move forward without digesting it somehow.
Right.
And so the first time I sat with the therapist, she was really great. We talked a little bit about what had happened. And she said, we can do one of two things, because my company actually paid for 8 sessions, which was great. She said, we can deal on the grief that you're going through, because you've lost John. You've lost the person that you thought John was.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a grief, she said, or we could work on why you would stay in this situation until it almost killed you. And I wisely chose the second. And then she started talking about codependency. And there's a lot of good books on there on my website. I have some books that I recommend. But as women, we're taught as little girls on up that we're the ones that we're the little homemakers, and we have the babies, and that we're dependent on the men. And then in order to have your home life happy, then you're going to do anything to make that person happy. That's the codependency comes into a lot of different situations, like dealing with alcoholism or drug addiction with loved ones, and we become enablers. And so because we want to help that person, and we tend to, I'll say, unvalidate ourselves would be a way of saying it. I mean, that's how one of those, can't think of his name now, one of the mass murderers, he would stop his car and he would be there with a crutch or like
Bundy.
Hmm?
Ted Bundy.
Yes. Yeah. And so what is he doing? They get on your sympathy. You know, like going back to, why did he have to say he had 4 kids? Well, you sympathize with him. You want to make it better. And that was it. And I wanted, during those 8 years, 9 years, I always wanted to try to get together with the family and talk with them and let them know I wasn't a gold digger. Of course, we never met him because there wasn't any, but... So codependency played a lot into my situation. And then the things of, why do you stay? Well, there was, first of all, loneliness. Why was he willing to come into my life? I had moved to a new town. My family, they were only 10 miles away or so, but I wasn't dating. And you don't realize, I'm in this new situation and we're lonely. And a lot of women, they're lonely. They want a man. And men too, they're lonely, they want a woman. And so you become vulnerable because these predators, they can smell that. You know, mm-hmm. Somehow they smell it. They know, oh, this person needy, she's lonely, And then the next thing is, as you're in these kind of situations and you get in deep enough, then you're operating out of fear too. There's a fear like in our case, that we were having financial trouble. So and there was a fear that, you know, my family would know about that. And then he would threaten that, because he never hit me until that last year when we went down the stairs. But there was always that fear. He would say, well, if you don't believe me, I'm just going to go kill myself. And then you get in that fear of, well, you don't want to have somebody kill themselves.
I'm manipulative. Yeah.
And then you have shame because in this, my case, this was a second marriage. And so I, you know, there's a shame there. Oh my God, I'm going to get another divorce and people are not going to think, they're going to think poorly of me or whatever. Now, I have to say that while those things were happening, I didn't really recognize them.
Right.
Because you're living in the day-to-day situation. And it was afterwards writing the book that I realized what was playing in the whole situation,
right,
of living with him. Yeah. It, yeah.
Listeners, every year around this time, I resolute I'm going to get grown-up stuff done, like get that colonoscopy over with that my doctor's been bugging me about, get my affairs in order, like making a will. And why is it that a will seems to be more daunting than the colonoscopy? Well, it doesn't have to, because trust and will makes creating your will easy. Like lounging on the couch easy. The website is really simple to use and the process is straightforward. Each will or trust is state-specific, legally valid, and customized to your needs. So for my family, my main concerns are guardians for my children. Whether your main concerns are your care wishes, your final arrangements, or power of attorney, Trust and Will has you covered. When maneuvering through the process, if you have any questions that stop you in your tracks, there is actually live support available through phone, chat, or email. Trust and Will has earned thousands of five-star reviews from Trustpilot. So check one of your goals off early this year with Trust and Will. Protect what matters most in minutes at trustandwill.com/HTC and get 10% off plus free shipping. That's 10% off and free shipping at trustandwill.com/HTC.
Embrace new beginnings. What a better way to start off 2025 than to learn a new language. I got Rosetta Stone over a year ago and have really enjoyed learning a couple different languages. Y'all know that when I went to Japan, I was learning Japanese, and now that my daughter is taking French in school, I am learning French through Rosetta Stone. It's amazing. It's been around for 30 years, so it is really the most trusted online tool to learn a new language. They have 25 different languages to choose from: Spanish, French, Italian, German, Japanese, Dutch. I mean, if you name it, they probably have it. I think that it's amazing, and you should think about doing this for your New Year's resolution too. It's convenient and flexible, and the value is unheard of. You get a lifetime membership for all 25 of those languages. Start your New Year's off with a resolution that you can reach. Today, Housewives of True Crime listeners are going to be able to take advantage of this New Year special from Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your New Year's offer at rosettastone.com/today.
Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for you, your kids, and your retirement, even during the holidays. You don't need to be an expert. Acorns will recommend a diversified portfolio that matches you. And you don't need a ton of time. You can create your Acorns account and start automatically investing your money in just 5 minutes. Acorns helps you build your financial future in the background so you can focus on all your holiday shopping and parties. So genius. Another great thing about Acorns is you don't need to be rich. Acorns lets you get started with the spare money you've got right now. That could be $5 a day or even just your spare change. That's right. Acorns can round every purchase you make up to the dollar automatically and invest your spare change for you. So that coffee you grab on the way to the mall, that's investing. And you get bonus investments just for buying the stuff you need from the brands you love. With Acorns, every single gift you buy this year could put more money in your investment account. It's like cash back, but the bonus investments have a chance to grow. So head to acorns.com/clink or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Pay client testimonial. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns investing. Involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, and SEC-registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/clink. Well, it sounds like, you know, when you're living out this situation with him, anytime you question or have a fear about something, I mean, he's kind of conditioned you to think that you're crazy for being concerned about these things.
Well, this type of personality, they're very good at manipulating you, and in ways that you don't even realize that they're manipulating you.
Right.
And he was never really yelled at me either. I mean, he was doing things like, I was at work and he would cook dinner, and, you know, it was just like, well, you know, then you think, well, everybody has financial problems one way or another in a marriage sometimes. And so this is just happening. And, you know, you're trying to move forward in your life and be happy and try to make everything work.
I wanted to ask, did you ever talk to him after he was, so once he went to, did you ever talk to him before you went to trial or after he went to trial or after he got out of prison?
So discussions with him were first, as I mentioned earlier, after the murder attempt, we talked on the bed, you know, why did you do that? And then when we were leaving, when I was leaving that mental facility and they were arresting him for attempted murder, I saw him sitting in another room and he had his hands were handcuffed behind his back. And so I went in and said, I don't know exactly what I said, you know, I'm leaving and, you know, whatever. And he said, well, tell him I didn't try to kill you. Tell him I didn't try to kill you. And I said, I'm sorry, John, I don't think that's the case this time, but something like that.
Yeah.
And then I was in the DC area for a couple of days and then I went to the jail to see him. And that was always interesting to, you know, it's like you see in the movies, you're sitting in the, there's the glass and you got the phone and he's trying to tell me that he didn't try to murder me. And he didn't, he needed me to get him an attorney. And I said, no, I don't think so. So that was really the last time I talked with him.
Okay.
Face to face that I can recall that, everything after that was through attorneys and.
Yes. Yeah. And then unfortunately he only got sentenced to 5 years and only served, I think, 14 months of the 5 years.
Right. Because he was older than me. And so the jury felt that he'd done this, but then they felt sorry for him. But even at that time, the law, it was in Virginia, he could have only gotten 10 years for first degree attempted murder, the way their laws were written at the time. And then when he was coming up for parole as the victim, I wasn't advised that he was getting off parole. And so now there's laws that I nothing to do but put in place, but there's laws that will, that the person, the victim, if they're alive, have, or the family of the victim, they need to be advised when the person is down.
Because we had talked about that where I was like, he's out. It hasn't been that long. And I was worried he was, you know, if you were worried he was going to come after you anymore, but in a way he did, because you had to then pay him alimony.
Well, the way that the divorce law was, as a no-fault divorce state, you know, they look at your tax records and, you know, and the way salaries would go. So, yeah, so I was required by law to pay him alimony, to give him half my 401k, to pay car and medical insurance on him, even though he was in jail until the divorce was, that was until the divorce was final. And, of course, half of all of our assets. And so I was able to negotiate with him to stay away from alimony and my retirement fund, because we had an annuity and I said, you could have the annuity for the rest of your life. But I still had to pay the car and medical insurance on him. And then my attorney fees, of course, every time they write a letter back and forth. And these personalities, these con men, they're very litigious. Mm-hmm. They love courtrooms. They love lawyers. They love the grandiosity of what they can perform. Mm-hmm. And so my attorney fees were racking up and my attorney says, you know, he says, you're an intelligent woman. He said, and I know you're not going to jeopardize the case. I'm going to file you as co-attorney on the case. And by doing that, I could work directly with John's attorney. And then I went to court twice representing myself and I won both times.
Wow.
Yeah.
It really is. And then you worked on changing the law.
Yes. Yeah. So sitting in the attorney's office, He said, I'm sorry, you know, that this is the law. And I even went to see Melvin Belli, who was a well-known attorney at the time in San Francisco. And he says, the law is the law. I said, I'd like to make that guy sleep with the fishes, but that's the law. And then I said, well, then the law needs to be changed. Mm-hmm. And I was told I couldn't change it because we are a no-fault divorce state. And it took me a year and a half to find somebody to carry the bill, which was Assemblyman Rainey. And then I got involved in changing a law, which I knew nothing about. I ended up becoming the sponsor of the bill. Usually an organization is a sponsor. And I was on the Capitol steps on the Victims Day gathering signatures to pass my bill, AB 16. We showed up. We were going to have our, and I had to get all the, anybody that was going to testify for the bill, I had to get the all that lined up. And then I showed up in the attorney in the assemblyman's office, and the legislator says, "Well, the chairman of the judiciary committee, where it was being held, was its first committee. He doesn't really want to do anything, and he wants to table the bill, and that meant that it would go into the next year's session, maybe." And I said, "No, I don't want to table the bill. I have people coming to testify and all." And well, you know, he doesn't really like some of the wording. Well, it was all the lawyers there in the assemblyman's office. They were put all the wording together, and some of it I didn't understand, but I thought they know what they're doing. I'm not the attorney. So last minute, we're sitting in a conference room in the assemblyman's office. There's all these attorneys sitting around there, and they're talking about this and that. And then I raised my hand. I said, "Excuse me." And on my name, EBT, I said, "Why can't we write this in plain English?" Mm-hmm. And so we did. We threw out the law. We lined everything out and basically said that if you're convicted of trying to murder a spouse, you do not get alimony. You do not get 401ks. You do not get car insurance, medical insurance. And you had to pay for the murderer had to pay for the divorce. So last minute, we're rushing back around. I'm delivering the rewritten bill to all the different committee members. And so we did had our hearing the next day, and I came through the committee without a negative vote. And then it went to the assembly, and that came through without a negative vote. Then there was word that in the Senate Judiciary Committee thought that this was a woman's bill. And so they were going to negate it. And again, I really feel a presence of a higher power in my life. And God sent me a male victim whose wife had hired people to murder him.
And there's a lot of those out there.
Yeah, there is.
It is a two-way street. Yeah.
And so I talked with he was reticent because it wasn't going to help him. Because seeing changing the law, it was not going to be retroactive. It was not going to help me. I just wanted to change the law to help others going forward. So on the day that we were going to testify at the Judiciary Committee, San Francisco news station came over and interviewed us, and their news van followed us to the committee meeting in Sacramento. And that night, my story was the lead story at 5 p.m. On having made it through the Judiciary Committee of the Senate. And it went to the Senate, and it passed out of there without a negative vote, and went to the governor's desk, and he signed it. So I proved him wrong. I changed the law of California.
That's amazing. And, you know, that is just like kudos, because I know, especially since it, you know, wasn't retroactive for you to go through all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I shared a story with Tabitha on New Year's Day. I was in Sonoma with two other ladies, and we were having dinner at a nice restaurant, and table next to us decided to send us a dessert. And so I went over to thank them and to find out, well, why. And the lady there, she said, "Oh, well, you guys were having such great fun, you know, three older ladies, you know, you just really laughing it up and having a good old time. And I just felt, you know, to send you a dessert." And we got talking and talking and talking, and very nice. They were from Southern California somewhere. And I went back to the table with my friends, and my one friend says, "You look like a deer caught in the headlights." And I said, "The lady just told me that her attorney used my law in 2009 to help her in her divorce."
Yeah.
Wow.
They did not even know that Barbara was the one. I mean, it is just, and there's probably so many more, right?
I mean, yeah, that's so incredible. She must have felt, I mean, because obviously she, to be able to use that law, she must have gone through some hellacious situation. And she must have felt some kind of kindred spirit to you from across the room.
Yeah.
Really, truly. Yeah. I mean, it is quite incredible. Your story is incredible. And it didn't stop there, Barbara, because when John finally croaked, you got a call.
Yeah, so I got a call and that he had passed, and he was in a mortuary in San Diego, and that the lady he was living with, he was doing the same con again with another woman, had moved in with her, and
he was the admiral again,
and he actually, I had gotten word to her through a third party to be careful, he was going to try to murder her, and they had the situation where he, the finances, I'm going to go on this business trip, yada yada, and then he did the well, I'm just going to go in the bedroom and with the shotgun and kill myself. And that lady, instead of going to the door, if she had gone to the bedroom door, she would have been dead. He would have shot her through the door. But something, maybe from what I had warned her, she left. And when she came back the next day, she and her brother found John dead in the kitchen. So now he's in the mortuary, and she's going to have him buried as an admiral and all of this. And so I called the mortuary, told them the story. And so they said, okay, we're going to release his body then to the county. And so he was in the county morgue, and he did autopsy. And they found most of the same drugs that I had recorded from back in Florida. And that's where I determined that he had this combination that he would make him look like he had a heart attack, because
remember
he was
going to
have a heart attack, and then she would come back and find him sick. And, you know, so that would be, you would go back into that codependency. Oh, I've got to take care of him that he's sick. Anyway, so now he's in the county for 6 weeks, and I need a death certificate so I can start taking care of financial issues. And they said, well, we can't release him because nobody's identified him yet that legally could identify him. And I said, well, I sat in a court of law, and he was legally identified as John Perry in that court of law, and I was married to him. So okay, you can identify him. Well, I said, I'll fly down to San Diego. I said, oh, well, that's okay. We'll fax you a picture of him, of this corpse.
Oh,
and I'm at work, and so I'm standing by the fax machine, you know, and yeah. So this picture comes across on the fax machine, and it was hard to see. So they faxed it again, and then finally I said, this is, it's serious, but I said, I can't identify him because he didn't have a toupee on. He'd been dead 6 weeks, and I hadn't seen him for a couple of years anyway. So I said, but I can identify him. He had this scar. It started in the middle of his chest and the breast, went all the way down before the belly button, all the way around, and then up his back, because his story was he had lost a lung in Vietnam. And I said, and I don't remember if it went to the left or to the right, but he had the scar, so they identified him. So now they were going to release him, and this lady was in the picture again, and she had him released to a different mortuary up in Oceanside. And I don't know how I found out what that one was, but I talked to them because she was going to have him cremated and buried with honors in the national in the cemetery down in San Diego area. And so I squelched that. So he was not buried with honors. And I think she took him home, put on the mantle or something.
Oh my gosh. She still didn't even think he was going to murder her.
No, she wasn't. I can imagine that having been his victim, he probably had a whole bunch of stories about me being the wicked witch of the West, and that I ruined his life and da 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 da. So that's why she hated, you know, she would hate me because
I had
put him in jail. I mean, I could just hear the story that he would have made up.
Right.
And so you never had any contact with her after there was no reason for you to, and she never reached out to you.
She did reach out. She reached out through lawyers and collected the $5,000 that John had never collected from the from my stock fund. Yeah.
Oh, stop it.
Oh.
You know, and it's sad. You know,
it is sad.
Oh my gosh, that is really unfortunate.
Yeah, that is.
Yep.
Wow.
And Tabitha had asked me also, did I fear him getting out of jail? Mm-hmm. And as I told her at that time, by that time the divorce was final. And so I wasn't afraid of him in that he would come try to murder me. There would be no financial gain. But I did try to keep tabs on him. And I hired a private investigator down in San Diego just to figure out what he was doing, you know, and then to find out that he was doing the same stuff again, you know, leveraging the same spot.
Yes. And then when he did pass, was there any relief that you felt?
I felt sad. I felt sad because, as I had found out, he was a tortured soul.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he was doing all these terrible things, but it started after having this head injury, you know? And, so I felt sad, that, you know, that he had this life that he did and that he hurt people that he did like he did. And, so his relief, you know, was he dead or not? I mean, again, I didn't fear for me anymore. So it wasn't any of that. It was just a sadness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I had asked you how, like, if you had any closure after talking to his family and even, you know, just when he passed. But, and when I asked that, Barbara, I feel like when you said there's not really ever closure, it's true, right?
Right. Like, I thought about this. I had not thought about this until I read your question, and I answered it first. And then I thought again afterwards that I said, you know, you never have closure. A victim or a victim's family never has closure. You can go through the trial. You know, they could be convicted of murder. They could be executed. But you never have closure, because in my case, I developed what I call now a PTSD. There are certain movies I can't watch that I become, hypertension, whatever. If there's something like good or bad, and the first time it happened was watching the movie Dances with Wolves, and the bad Indians were attacking the good Indians, and I had this panic attack. That was a panic attack. And it was, an hour later, I'm at the doctor's, and my blood pressure at that time, an hour later, was 190 something over something. You know, it was skyrocketing. Basketball games. I can't only watch about 5 or 10 minutes of a basketball game. There's conflict. It's conflict, and it's nothing that you can control.
Right.
It's there. And my final answer to you is I don't think I'll have closure until the day I die. I still have every now and then nightmares with these in it, not trying to murder me necessarily, but just conning and, you know, there never is full closure. But the closure that you can look at is saying, okay, I did put that behind me, and I went on and I've created this life. I had 25 years of marriage to a wonderful man, you know, and he passed in December of 2022. And again, God takes care of things. I was probably not in the right frame of mind taking care of him. I was his full-time caregiver. So 2 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to do this.
Right.
I'm traveling now. Some girlfriends and I, we travel. And then I have a special friend that we're going to go to Australia next year. And just keep myself active. And I'm writing another book.
And she's writing another book.
That's great.
Yeah. Yes.
So we don't know what the title of your new book will be, but when it does come out, I will definitely tell all of our listeners. But what about your book that they can listen to right now? They can listen to it, or they can read it audio, because it is on audiobooks too, I think.
No, it's not on audio.
It's not. Okay.
No. It's listed on Amazon. It's in libraries. All across the United States. Now, whether or not it's been filtered out by now, I don't know. It was in libraries in Canada.
Yeah. I got mine on Amazon. So it is on Amazon. I know that. Well, in 2022, and it's called Dancing with the Devil.
A Dance with the Devil, a true story of a psychopath.
Yep. So I suggest that. Also, please visit Barbara's website. You can get that to
www.adancewiththedevil.com. You can also put Barbara Bentley in the search field and you'll come up with it.
Yes. And then you'll see her lovely face and then get to her website. And I'm sure there's plenty of us that need to go to your website that are listening now just to get some resources. And I mean, your work is fabulous. You're an advocate for people that have been in situations like yours and others in domestic violence, and just figuring out how to navigate that, because it's definitely not easy. So thank you so much for coming on with us, Barbara. We truly, really appreciate it. You are a true hero. And when I said that to you before, I really do mean it.
Thank you. And, you know, we never mentioned the little book of success that when I was writing my first book, mm-hmm. I realized that there were 4 tools I used in my life to become a success. And it's self-published. It's a little book of success. It's little. But I found that passion, planning, patience, and persistence. No matter what you want to do in life, if you use those 4 tools, you can accomplish it. Passion, you've got to believe in what you're doing. If you don't have passion, it's going to fail somewhere along the way. It's like passion is your good foundation. Mm-hmm. And then you go with planning. Doesn't mean it has to be 1, 2, 3, 4 on a piece of paper, but you know, okay, when I was going to write a book, I knew I needed to take some writing classes. And so what I've done with those 4 tools is I've gone through my life and I've used 4 examples. One was writing the book. One was going back and getting a university degree, summa cum laude, while working. One was building a house with my first husband, and one was changing the law. So I show how I use passion for those 4 things, and then the next chapter is how did I use planning in those 4 things. So it's just a little book. but it does give ideas to what you can apply to your own lives, you know, that to be the best of whatever it is you want to be.
I love that. I love that. So where can people find that book?
Amazon.com and on my webpage also.
I'm going to get that. Thank you for that. That is awesome. I'm going to read that because I think I need, I have a lot of passion. I just need, I need, what would Gretchen say? You need more planning.
Well, we all do, you know, no matter what we want to tackle. And the only reason I'm doing my, this third book, and I will go for a standard publisher, is it's a true story about a strong woman from Irish history. And she was born into Anglo-Irish aristocracy. And she turns up becoming a rebel in the rising of 1916. So it's she's a very, very interesting person.
Wow.
And my working title is Becoming Irish, but whether or not that's the working title, I don't know.
Yeah. When you get those publishers, they like to change things up on you.
Yeah.
Any other questions, Gretchen Poo?
I think I'm good. Just it was such a pleasure. And thanks for spending this time with us.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again. And thank you for all the good work that you do with agreeing to spread the word through your podcast.
Yeah, we're trying. Yes.
Very important.
Thank you.
And here's my last thought. No one's story is more important than another's. What's important is how we take our talent to help others.
Yeah, I like that, Barbara. Thank you.
That's a great spot to end on.
Yes, it is. Well, that is a wrap of just amazingness from a woman, one woman's story that really changed the lives of so many.
Absolutely.
And she keeps going. She's nonstop.
Yeah, she is nonstop. I mean, isn't it just like, I can't get over the fact that a law had to be put into place that you can't take like someone's money from them if they attempt to murder you. It seems like such common sense.
It 100% does. I mean, I was mind blown knowing that.
Yeah.
And I also didn't know until we recorded this and spoke with her that the law didn't matter to her anyways.
Right. Yeah. Because she's a disco biscuit explosion.
I know.
She just did it for the love of helping other people. And it just, it takes a lot of stories to be told for people to really understand that it can happen to anyone. And, you know, I curse all those people that would say, how stupid could she be on Amazon? Shame on you.
Oh, you know, she's right. It's the people that are doing it to other people. It's
right.
It's not somebody that, you know, it's there's no way, because if you listen to her story, you know how smart she is. She's an intelligent woman. She got conned, and it is very easy to do. It's very easy. I mean, look at this guy. He
got into the inaugural ball.
I mean, I tried to get that, and I didn't, and I even knew somebody working for the president, and I couldn't even get there.
Uh-huh. How come this is not surprising at all?
What? That happened to me?
That you? We can tie it into you almost going to the inaugural ball, fancy pants.
I
know, but you know somebody.
I knew somebody, but it didn't help me at all.
And listen, you guys have heard, she gets out of tickets. If she can't get in,
I feel like it was work. It's true. Very true. Yeah. No, I did not get in. I did try. Maybe next time. No, because it's not, I don't know anybody working for the president anymore, so I'm not getting there. But anyways, thank you all for listening. This was a very special bonus episode that we are happy to present. And thank you again to Barbara. Was such a pleasure, and she is really the epitome of a disco biscuit. Clink, clink,
clink, clink.
Some things you wouldn't mind being stuck with, like a huge inheritance. But a phone that has to be plugged in just right so it charges is not one of those things. Switch to Verizon and we'll pay off your old phone up to $800 via prepaid MasterCard for a new one on us. Just trade in any phone from our top brands with select unlimited plans. $829.99 purchase with new smartphone line on select unlimited plans. Minimum $90 per month with auto pay plus taxes and fees for 36 months required. Less $830 trade-in slash promo credit applied over 36 months. Trade-in terms apply. Payoff phone requires smartphone purchase and port-in with new smartphone line on select plan. Must provide most recent bill showing payoff amount of eligible phone. Additional terms apply.